Chapter 6. Afghanistan again. Bin Laden has always had something of a romantic attachment to Afghanistan, sometimes referring to it by its ancient Muslim name of Khorasan, and on one occasion signing his declaration of war against the West with a notation that it was written in the Hindu Kush Mountains. It was also a country bin Laden knew intimately, as he had fought the communists there on and off for 7 years between 1985 and 1992. In the years since bin Laden had moved from Peshawar to Sudan, an armed fundamentalist movement, the Taliban, meaning religious students, had gradually taken over Afghanistan. The movement was an alliance between the graduates of Afghan and Pakistani madrasas, impoverished young Afghan refugees who had grown up in Pakistan, and leaders of the Pashtun tribal grouping, including, at least initially, Hamid Karzai, who became Afghanistan's president after the fall of the Taliban. The Taliban first emerged in Kandahar in 1994 under the leadership of an enigmatic, reclusive leader, the one-eyed Mullah Omar. The Taliban enjoyed quite a high degree of popularity and legitimacy in their earlier years, as they brought order and a measure of peace to a country that had suffered through a decade and a half of civil war. The Taliban also initially suggested they might restore Afghanistan's monarchy, an institution that continued to enjoy great popularity. And the Taliban were also seen as incorruptible and little interested in assuming power for themselves. However, Lord Acton's maxim that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely is an almost perfect description of how the Taliban regime evolved over the years. The Taliban increasingly turned their law and order government into something that aspired to be a truly totalitarian Islamic state. The Taliban were neither modern enough nor competent enough to succeed in that project, but they certainly tried hard. For bin Laden, the fact that the Taliban were consolidating their hold on Afghanistan just as he returned to the country would be a fortuitous gift that he would exploit brilliantly, entering into a powerful symbiotic relationship with Mullah Omar. Al-Qaeda would provide the Taliban some much-needed cash and zealous Arab fighters, while the Taliban would provide a sure refuge and carte blanche to build up the training camps of the Al-Qaeda organization. Bin Laden would say that Afghanistan was destined to be the Medina of the 21st century, a reference to the Arabian city to which the Prophet Muhammad immigrated from his native Mecca in the year 622 to build up his Islamic army, which seized Mecca from its pagan inhabitants 8 years later. Indeed, bin Laden saw his own emigration, or hijra, to Afghanistan as self-consciously replicating the hijra of the Prophet from Mecca to Medina 14 centuries earlier. Once in Afghanistan, under the patronage of the Taliban, bin Laden would launch his holy war in earnest against the United States, a campaign that began with statements issued against the Crusaders and the Jews in 1996 that would then be amplified by bellicose interviews on CNN, ABC News, and Al Jazeera, and that would take concrete shape across three continents with the U.S. Embassy attacks in Africa in 1998, the USS Cole attack in Yemen in 2000, and finally, 9/11 itself. Parallel to this, Al-Qaeda developed a number of training camps during this period that would churn out thousands of graduates, many of whom would simply be cannon fodder for the war against Ahmad Shah Massoud's reviled Northern Alliance, while more promising graduates would receive advanced training in terrorist tactics and the production of crude weapons of mass destruction. The years between 1996 and 2001 are when bin Laden reached the apogee of his power. In Afghanistan, he was able to create his own jihad kingdom, as if the man who would be king was remade as a jihadist epic. While he publicly professed fealty to the Taliban leader, Mullah Omar, in practice, bin Laden paid little attention to the Taliban's repeated efforts to stop his attacks on the West, doing pretty much as he pleased throughout his 5-year stay in Afghanistan as the Taliban's honored guest. On July 18, 1996, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence Research which has a well-deserved reputation for the consistently excellent quality of its analysis, prepared a top-secret document entitled Terrorism/Osama bin Laden, Who's Chasing Whom? The document summarized the Bureau's understanding of al-Qaeda's leader after his departure from Sudan and its analysis of the implications of his likely relocation to Afghanistan. The documents were made public under a Freedom of Information Act request and were declassified in July 2005. Key excerpts follow. Terrorism/Osama bin Laden, Who's Chasing Whom? Bin Laden's Homecoming. Bin Laden would feel comfortable returning to Afghanistan, where he got his start as a patron and mujahid during the war with the former Soviet Union. Afghanistan may be an ideal haven as long as bin Laden can continue to run his businesses and financial networks. His prolonged stay in Afghanistan, where hundreds of Arab mujahideen receive terrorist training and key extremist leaders often congregate, could prove more dangerous to U.S. interests in the long run than his 3-year liaison with Khartoum. On the run? With pressure against him mounting from the United States and some Muslim states, especially Saudi Arabia and Egypt, bin Laden seemingly should be on the run. But his willingness to speak more openly to the press about his militant opposition to the Saudi regime and the West suggests more a man emboldened by recent events, whether or not he was involved in them. Vahid Mojeh is an Afghan who worked with Abdullah Azam's and bin Laden's service office during the 80s in Peshawar. Between 1995 and the fall of the Taliban in 2001, he held several posts in various divisions of the Afghan Foreign Affairs Ministry. He published an insider's account of his time as a Taliban official, Afghanistan under 5 years of Taliban sovereignty, in late 2001. Extracts from the book follow. The Taliban movement was not initially a political organization. In fact, the movement was formed to remove the groups that had fomented civil war in Afghanistan during the early 90s. The Taliban disarmed armed groups. They removed all checkpoints on transit routes and brought security. It was precisely these sorts of actions that ordinary people were interested in seeing. By securing the roads, Taliban received financial aid from tradesmen. Before entering Kabul in September of 1996, the Taliban alleged that they had no intention of ruling Afghanistan. The Taliban's greatest problem in forming a government was that they were rural people, and when they entered Kabul, they faced open conflicts with urban values and requirements. As time passed, it became evident that the Taliban's intention went well beyond the imposition of rural values in an urban setting. Women and girls were prohibited to work and get an education. Women could only move about the city under the long burqa. Men were not allowed to shave their beards, as it was considered a crime. Wearing turbans became mandatory in governmental offices and schools. Recruitment and employment in the Taliban's governmental offices was also strange. The majority of the officials were titled mullah, an honorary religious title. Even in places where specialists were needed to carry out technical projects, the majority of employment belonged to barely literate Taliban, or those known as mullah. The Taliban movement initially had a consultative system, with Mullah Omar at the head, but after the invasion of Kabul, consultation faded as many members were assigned to government posts. The quiet dissolution of this council granted ill-defined but unlimited power and control to Mullah Omar as Amir al-Mu'mineen, the leader of the faithful, and thus he could rule the country by issuing whatever order he wished to. The Taliban movement was not essentially political, and its leaders were extremely religious individuals. In some instances, such as with Mullah Omar, mystic inclinations were apparent. Many of them had no knowledge beyond a few religious books, and their worldly perspective was limited to a couple of provinces in Afghanistan. Their understanding of political matters was completely auditory, the result of listening to radio news or talking with people. The majority of these leaders had no desire to study anything but the Holy Quran and religious texts. Osama and his loyalists were, of course, well aware of how to influence the Taliban relying on their previous experiences with Mujahideen leaders. The purchase of expensive automobiles from Mullah Omar and his loyalists was the first step in that direction. Financial support in the war against the Taliban's opposition, in particular buying off the opposing commanders, proved to be an effective strategy. Osama thus established himself among the Taliban in a position far above that of a mere guest. Using his own financial assets, Osama bin Laden successfully positioned himself among the Taliban. Abu Walid al-Misri, the Egyptian journalist who worked with al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The Taliban leadership consisted of Mullah Muhammad Omar, who lost his right eye while fighting against the Soviets, along with the Taliban Shura Council, which consisted of 15 people, 12 of whom were severely wounded in the same war and had lost body parts. Hatayfa Azam, Abdullah Azam's son, who spent time in Afghanistan in the mid-90s. When bin Laden first arrived in Afghanistan, he wrote a letter to Mullah Omar saying, "I want to come to your areas, but I need a promise from you that you are going to protect me. You will never surrender me." Mullah Omar sent him the answer, "You are most welcome. We will never give you up to anyone who wants you." Osama bin Laden's first declaration that he was at war with the United States was issued August 23, 1996, 3 months after his return to Afghanistan. A significant extract follows, laying out bin Laden's case against the West, and the U.S. in particular, a case that has been quite consistent over time. Conventional wisdom has it that bin Laden adopted the Palestinian issue only recently. Reading this declaration should put that canard to rest. It should not be hidden from you that the people of Islam had suffered from aggression, iniquity, and injustice imposed on them by the Zionist Crusaders' alliance and their collaborators, to the extent that the Muslims' blood became the cheapest and their wealth as loot in the hands of the enemies. Their blood was spilled in Palestine and Iraq. The horrifying pictures of the massacre of Qana in Lebanon, when Israeli forces struck a UN compound on date April 18, 1996, killing 100, are still fresh in our memory. Massacres in Tajikistan, Burma, Kashmir, the Philippines, Somalia, Eritrea, and Chechnya, and in Bosnia-Herzegovina took place. Massacres that send shivers in the body and shake the conscience. The latest and the greatest of these aggressions, incurred by the Muslims since the death of the Prophet, is the occupation of the land of the two holy places, referring to the presence of tens of thousands of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia. By orders from the USA, they also arrested a large number of scholars in the land of the two holy places, among them the prominent Sheikh Salman al-Awda and Sheikh Safar al-Hawali. Myself and my group have suffered some of this injustice. We have been pursued in Pakistan, Sudan, and Afghanistan, hence this long absence on my part. But by the grace of Allah, a safe base is now available in the high Hindu Kush mountains in Khorasan, an archaic Islamic name for Afghanistan. The presence of the USA Crusader military forces on land, sea, and air of the states of the Islamic Gulf is the greatest danger threatening the largest oil reserve in the world. My Muslim brothers, the money you pay to buy American goods will be transformed into bullets and used against our brothers in Palestine. By buying these goods, we are strengthening their economy while our poverty increases. We expect the women of the land of the two holy places and other countries to carry out their role in boycotting the American goods. The security and the intelligence services of the entire world cannot force a single citizen to buy the goods of his or her enemy. The boycotting of American goods is a very effective weapon of weakening the enemy. I rejected those who enjoy fireplaces and clubs discussing eternally. I respect those who carried on, not asking or bothering about the difficulties, never letting up from their goals, in spite all hardships of the road. I feel still the pain of the loss of Al-Quds in my internal organs. Al-Quds, Jerusalem, the site of the third holiest place of pilgrimage in Islam, was annexed to Israel in 1967. That loss is like a burning fire in my intestines. More than 600,000 Iraqi children have died due to lack of food and medicine and as a result of the unjustifiable UN sanctions imposed on Iraq and its nation. The children of Iraq are our children. You, the USA, are responsible for the shedding of the blood of these innocent children. The walls of oppression and humiliation cannot be demolished except in a rain of bullets. The free man does not surrender leadership to infidels and sinners. My Muslim brothers of the world, your brothers in Palestine and in the land of the two holy places are calling upon your help and asking you to take part in fighting against the enemy, your enemy and their enemy, the Americans and the Israelis. Abdul Bari Atwan, the editor of Al-Quds Al-Arabi, the independent Arabic language newspaper based in London, met bin Laden 3 months after he had issued the fatwa declaring war on America. I decided to meet bin Laden in November 1996 for many reasons. First, we were a newspaper which was not under the umbrella of Saudi Arabia. Most of the Arab media is controlled by the Saudis. Nobody else could interview him and publish the interview except me. But to be honest, I was hesitant, because it is very dangerous. And also, I didn't want to clash directly with the Saudi government because I know this is the archenemy of the royal family. And I wanted to stay away from internal Saudi politics at that time, as our newspaper actually was really facing a lot of trouble with the Saudis. I met Khalid Fawaz, bin Laden's media contact in London, and he said, "Are you interested in meeting Osama bin Laden?" I was told that Osama bin Laden was fond of my writing. He liked my style, and he wanted to meet me personally. I remember the first interview was supposed to be September 1996. So Khalid Fawaz said to me, "You have to go to New Delhi. You take the plane to Jalalabad, and in Jalalabad they will take care of you." I made my inquiries, and I wasn't that keen on that. It was frightening, to be honest. And thank God, Khalid Fawaz phoned me a week before, and he said to me, "There is no need for travel now because it is dangerous." I said, "What's dangerous?" He said, "The Taliban have moved into Jalalabad, and we don't know what will happen to Osama bin Laden, so wait a bit." Thank God they actually changed their plans and changed their minds. And I was really relieved, to be honest. In November 1996, they called me again. They said, "Now it is safe to go to Jalalabad." I didn't even tell my wife where I am going. I told only one colleague of mine at this newspaper. I told her, "I am going to meet Osama bin Laden. This is top secret. If anything happens to me, I have this money, I have this mortgage, I have these bills." Mohammed Atef, at the time Al-Qaeda's military commander, was very, very pleased to see me, and he was very happy because I managed to make the trip to Jalalabad. And he was really nice, very hospitable, very charming person, and he was very smart, you know. Dark skin and green eyes, very beautiful green eyes. I was taken with different people to Tora Bora, the mountain which is looking over Jalalabad. And it was a trip in a pickup car. It was full of those armed men sitting outside, and there were two seats in the cabin. The first one is for the driver, two people sitting behind him, and the second seat was mine, and then there was another militiaman sitting right beside me. There was snow at that time. It was very cold, freezing. And then to the favorite cave of Osama bin Laden. And actually, it was a very simple cave, and he was waiting. There were two rooms. The first room was boxes. And then there was some sort of a living room inside with beds, and there were lots of people. 5 minutes after my arrival, all of them left the cave with bin Laden. There were anti-aircraft guns and rockets. I was left in the cave. I thought the Americans have discovered our place and they are bombing us. And so started reciting the Quran and thinking, this is the end of me, seriously. And then after 20 minutes, they came back and they said, "Sorry, it was a military maneuver. We do it sometimes." I was really horrified. I was scared to death. To be honest, it is a mystery whether they are doing it to impress me, whether they are doing it because they thought maybe I could be tracked by American intelligence, or they were routinely doing it. But after half an hour, they repeated it again. And then we had dinner. Dinner was really awful. There were about 12 people in that cave. The dinner was rotten cheese, this Egyptian cheese. It's salty cheese. It's really very bad. The peasants eat it in Egypt in particular. And then there was a potato soaked in cottonseed oil. And also there were about 5 or 6 fried eggs and bread, which was really caked with sand. So I think this is their food, typical food. They eat very little. It's bin Laden who actually loves to live such a harsh life with his followers. And that's why his son, Abdullah, left this harsh life and decided to go back to Saudi Arabia.
This ends Disc 6, The Osama Bin Laden I Know, Disc 7.
Abu Jandal, former Bin Laden bodyguard, now living in Yemen. Bin Laden's eldest son, Abdullah, returned to Saudi Arabia in 1995 after making an arrangement with his uncles and the Saudi ruling family. He wanted to return and settle in Saudi Arabia. Abdullah returned to Saudi Arabia because his views did not agree with his father's. As he saw it, he came from a wealthy family and deserved to live well on the money his family had. This view was completely at odds with his father's. Sheikh Osama avoided mentioning Abdullah's name after this because he had been hurt by him. He wished that his eldest son had remained with him to help him. He respected his son's wishes, however, and allowed him to return to Saudi Arabia. Hutaifa Azam, Abdullah Azam's son. I met Abdullah bin Laden in Dubai when he was coming from Sudan, and we spent more than 3 weeks. This was in 95. Abdullah was totally different from his father. Abdul Bari Atwan, the Palestinian editor of Al-Quds Al-Arabi newspaper. To be honest, the man is likable. He is really nice. You don't see him as somebody who will be the arch-terrorist, who will be the most dangerous man in the world. He doesn't strike you as a charismatic. You are with somebody who you feel you knew for maybe 10 to 15 years. You don't feel a stranger when you meet him for the first time. And he doesn't try to impress you. I met a lot of Palestinian leaders. They try to impress you. This man does not try to impress you. Maybe this is his strength. Maybe this is his style. He was extremely natural, very simple, very humble, and soft-spoken. You feel he is shy. He doesn't look at you eye to eye. Usually when he talks to you, he talks by looking down. His clothes are very, very humble, very simple. He is not on the defensive, neither on the offensive. And he was a very good listener. You know, he is not like us. We Arabs interrupt the speaker. No, he waits until you finish your sentence and finish your argument, and then he comments with little words. He's not really noisy like us, you know. It was an important interview for them for two reasons. First, because it is in Arabic. Osama bin Laden was pleased to talk to the Arab world, and he was pleased to talk to the Saudis and the Arabian Peninsula in particular. And it seemed he wanted media exposure. His major priority is the Arabic audience. He wanted to declare war in his language. Now he went a step further, or maybe more than 10 steps further. He wants to say, now I am an international figure. I'm not just a Saudi. I am aggrieved at Americans who are occupying Saudi Arabia, who are desecrating the Holy Land. That's the most important message he wanted to say. I didn't expect him to actually declare a war against the United States. I expected him maybe just to concentrate on the Saudi regime, the Saudi royal family, but he surprised me. Osama bin Laden, in the beginning, never actually presented himself as a religious scholar. He never gave the impression that he has the authority to issue a fatwa. He used to rely on the fatwas of other ulema, clerics. From the intellectual point of view, at that time, he was working very hard in his theological background. You can see in the cave there were a lot of textbooks about the Quran, about Ibn Taymiyyah, the medieval Muslim scholar who has provided much of the theological ballast for jihadist movements. He was actually influenced by their teaching. And incidentally, on my way to see him, the driver was playing tapes of Safir al-Halawi, a militant Saudi cleric who influenced bin Laden. So he was also influenced by those people, by the new breed of Islamist scholars in Saudi Arabia. There was something really strange. I took my tape recorder, and then when I asked Mohammed Atef why you don't want me to tape this, he just says, Bin Laden doesn't want his voice to be recorded. He doesn't want to make mistakes and have a recording, and when it is taped, it might be used against him. I am not a religious man. I am not fundamentalist. And so, for them, they can't trust me. I'm not one of them. So that's why when he told me that he doesn't want to make mistakes on the tape in Arabic, because it's not good for a preacher to make grammatical mistakes in Arabic. Bin Laden's Arabic was actually a classical Arabic. It is very correct Arabic, no grammatical mistakes, full of verses of the Quran, full of hadiths, sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. I met his two sons, Saad and I think Ali. They were 13, 14, and they were playing Nintendo in the compound where the family lives in Jalalabad. In 1996, I asked him why you are not fighting the Jews, for example, the Israelis. And I said, you know, you are criticized because of this. He actually did not have answer for that. It seems he was surprised with my question. In that time, Osama bin Laden also wasn't liked by the Arab nationalists, leftists who are the majority in the Arab world, because he fought Soviet Union, which was the ally of the Arabs. The PLO used to be considered as atheist organization by Osama bin Laden because they sided with the Soviet Union. He considers the late PLO leader Yasser Arafat as a traitor and a secularist. He hated his guts. He also didn't like Saddam Hussein, and he still considered Saddam Hussein as a man who is a secular, but he didn't actually insult Saddam Hussein the way he insulted Yasser Arafat. He didn't like him, and he told me he wanted to kick him out of Iraq, as he considered the Ba'ath Iraqi socialist regime to be an atheist regime. He considered Saddam Hussein as atheist, and he hates an atheist. We didn't talk about his personal life. We never talked about his wives or something like that because it is a taboo. He took me on a tourist tour in Tora Bora. We walked for about 2 hours together. We left the cave about 8 o'clock in the morning. It was freezing. And so we went around and the sun started and it was really beautiful, and he showed me the houses of some of his people, their mud bricks houses there above the snow. He loved that nature there. He loved the mountain. They were trying to have their own community, grow their foods, and they are marrying each other. It's like an oasis in Afghanistan. You can see their children play together, their families get together, the men together. They have their own food, they bake their bread. I was told, actually, he wasn't living in that cave. I was told he chose to meet me in that cave because he loves it. Because this cave, in particular, in Tora Bora, he used to stay during the jihad against the Soviet Union. And he told me he fought a lot of battles in Tora Bora, and they managed to win one of the battles in that place, so it is very dear to him. The other thing is he loves the mountain, as he told me. He said, I really feel secure in the mountains. I really enjoy my life when I'm here. I feel secure in this place. I asked him, if you are going to be kicked out of Afghanistan one day, the way you were kicked out of Saudi Arabia and Sudan, where will you go? He said, you know, Abdul Bari, I will go to Yemen. The mountains of Yemen, because it is exactly like Tora Bora. I love the mountains. He was in perfect health. He never complained about how high it was in the mountains, and it was freezing. He had dry mouth most of the time. I noted that he drinks a lot of water and tea. He told me how he hated Americans, and even he wanted to defeat them even in his agriculture project. So he was actually the happiest man on earth when he managed to produce a sunflower, which is a record in its size, much bigger than the American sunflower. He said, even I defeated them in agriculture. He was very proud of his sunflower. After the fall of the Taliban, I toured Tora Bora, where Abdul Bari Atwan had interviewed bin Laden, to get a feel for the place that al-Qaeda's leader clearly loves. The caves that dot the hills of Tora Bora are small affairs, suitable for shelter from bombardments, but are certainly not the caves of a James Bond villain. The buildings that make up the Tora Bora settlement, more properly known as Malawa, are strung across a series of ridges. When I visited in January 2005, the former al-Qaeda settlement was above the snow line, commanding lovely views of the verdant valleys below. I was guided around the buildings by a local woodcutter. Now, all destroyed after the U.S. bombing campaign, they comprised a series of scattered lookout posts, a bakery, and bin Laden's two-bedroom house, all constructed of the baked mud typical of Afghan villages. Incongruously, next to bin Laden's house was a crude swimming pool, which was also in ruins. In front of bin Laden's house lay a broad field, now scarred by bomb craters, where al-Qaeda members cultivated their crops. It all had the feel of a hippie commune that somehow had been airlifted into the Hindu Kush Mountains. The overwhelming sensation was one of tranquility and distance from modern civilization. From bin Laden's house, all he would have been able to see was his own little feudal fiefdom. The nearest village is out of sight, thousands of feet below, down a scree-covered slope. 2 hours down the rocky road from Tora Bora, which winds its way past tiny Afghan villages, babbling brooks and orchards, is the main al-Qaeda compound in an area called Hadda, a neighborhood of massive, walled compounds that lies just outside the city of Jalalabad. The Hadda compound is spread over 2 acres, a complex of some 75 rooms, a place that could house hundreds of people. Across the road was another large al-Qaeda compound. A group of local boys showed me an entrance to a secret chamber in the compound that extended at least 50 feet underground. Both buildings had been largely destroyed by U.S. airstrikes. Saif Allah, a 15-year-old boy who, like many Afghans, has only one name, lives in the house next door to bin Laden's compound.
It was very hard to see Osama. You couldn't see him. He came here in four-wheel drives with blacked-out windows. Arab guards patrolled around here at night. They didn't hire locals as guards or cooks. It was a secret place. They checked anybody coming by. Osama is a very nice guy. He's a great holy warrior. Why do they say he's a murderer and a bad guy? Osama is a hero.
The Egyptian-Canadian Qadr family lived with the bin Laden family in Jalalabad. What follows are extracts of Abdurrahman Qadr's testimony in the case of Adil Sharkawi before the Federal Court of Canada, July 13, 2004. Qadr's testimony was made as part of the defense for Sharkawi, who was appealing his detention by Canadian authorities. My father is from Egypt. He is a citizen of Canada. Our permanent house was in Pakistan from 85 until 96. After 96, our house was in Jalalabad. We got a house in the city and we had a house up north of the city in Al-Qaeda compound. Osama bin Laden and all the members that are around him all lived in this compound. More or less 250 people. We stayed in Jalalabad from mid-1996 until mid-1997. In mid-1997, a commander of the Northern Alliance threatened to attack Jalalabad, so the Taliban were concerned about Osama and the compound. So they insisted on Osama that he move his compound from Jalalabad to Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. We then moved to Kabul, where we rented a house, and we were staying in that house from 1999 until 2001. My first trip to Khaldan training camp in Afghanistan, I think, was in mid-95. I'm not sure about the time exactly, but I know I was 11 at the point that I first went. And then I went there every year in the summer breaks, and I spent 2 to 4 months there. As I learned later, it was Al-Qaeda training camp. They insisted that a person do something with his training, kill an American or trying to go into suicide bombing. So there was a lot of mental training in Al-Qaeda camps. In 98, when I was 14, I went to an Al-Qaeda camp which was Jihad Wel Al-Farouk. I was sent to Jihad Wel because my father thought that I was old enough or mature enough to be sent to a bigger camp where there is more mental training and psychological training. I was there for 7 days. Yes, my father was a good friend of Osama bin Laden. Yes, my father admired Osama bin Laden. Yes, Osama bin Laden attended my sister's wedding. Yes, my father, being in admiration with Mr. bin Laden, therefore approved of Mr. bin Laden's methods and ideologies. Yes, if Mr. bin Laden condoned violence, my father condoned violence too. I described him, my father, before as a member of Al-Qaeda, and to my father it was a freedom fight, not terrorism. To him this was a group of the last Muslims surviving to defend Islam. That is what it was to him. I am against them because it is violence. It is killing of innocent people. It is not what Islam calls for. Islam, for me, is a peaceful religion. I am against American troops being in Saudi Arabia. I am against it all the way, but I do not deal with it the way Osama does. Osama bin Laden is against Western things like Tabasco and ICE. ICE is not even American, but it is a luxury of life, and he doesn't want his people to get used to that. Between 98 and 2001, when I was aged 14 to 19, my father sat me down with this religious scholar and the military trainer, and they talked about my serving as a suicide bomber. We even discussed which clothes I would be wearing,
that I would shave my beard, that I would wear a Walkman. And I was like, no, no, no. Zainab Qadr is a sister of Abdurrahman Qadr. Terence McKenna, a correspondent for the Canadian Broadcast Corporation, interviewed Zainab Qadr in Pakistan for the CBC documentary Al-Qaeda Family, a profile of the Qadr family and their relationship with bin Laden, which aired on February 22, 2004. Excerpts of the interview follow. When we lived in Jalalabad, that was the first time that I met them, bin Laden's family. Actually, it's not that they're not social people, the women in bin Laden's family, they're very social. But they have lots of restrictions. Where they go, when they go, where they come, when they come, who visits to them and how long you can stay in their house and all that. So you can't really have an intimate relationship with them, and you can't be really going and coming because they have to watch many things. I heard about it, bin Laden interacting with his children. I never saw it. Men and women don't mix. But as far as I know, it was very important for him to sit with his kids every day at least for 2 hours in the morning after their morning prayer. They sit and read a book, at least. It didn't have to be something religious. He loved poetry very much. So he tried to encourage them to read, memorize, and write poetry. So every once in a while it would be a different book. Sometimes it's about poetry. Sometimes it's about history. Or sometimes it's about grammar, language. Sometimes a religious book. He loved playing volleyball and loved horse riding. And he'd do it. I mean, amongst people, he was not Osama bin Laden. He was just Osama. And kids played around him. Kids would go shake his hand. He played volleyball with them or just horse race with them. He was just a normal person. And they'd go shooting, he'd go with them. If he missed his target, they'd laugh at him and stuff like that. He didn't allow his children to drink cold water. Probably because he didn't believe in using modern conveniences, because he wanted them to be prepared that one day there's no cold water, they'd be able to survive, and it wouldn't be so difficult for them. He didn't like to buy American soft drinks, Coke and Pepsi and all that. But his kids sometimes would buy them. And he liked them to live more natural. They had horses and camels. I mean, he's a Saudi or more of a Bedouin. They love horses and camels, and they had them even in their compound. But one of his kids loved cars, so whatever allowance his father was giving him, he got enough money to buy himself a car.